On the tape we heard a voice, new to us, which sounded rather cold and authoritative. You may ask questions now. App, is Zarigo one of your subjects?
Yes.
Do you need proof?
App, the best proof for me is to have him tell me about my ears.
Arrigo says that he tried to cure your left side.
Why did you stop taking his medicines?
App, I became allergic to the streptomycin, and I stopped that part of the treatment. See page 30. He says to start the same medicines again, it will not hurt you this time.
Arrigo says that he was not hurt in the car crash, there was no pain. He left his body before the crash. He will bring back something for you.
App, thank you and Arrigo. I do not know your name. How shall I address you? We have been calling you the intelligence from the sky, or is. You may use the name Spectra. But actually Spectra is the name of a spacecraft which we use as you use a planet. It has been stationed for the past 800 years over the Earth. It is as big as one of your cities on Earth. But only you can see us.
App, why are you interested in the Israelis?
The Israeli territory is where we first landed on Earth. That is why we are interested in them. Be patient, for years. You will have everything in time.
App, are there other people on Earth with whom you work?
There is no other on Earth that we will use for the next 50 years but you and Uri. The tape vanished after this transmission. On February 9, 1972, Uri and I made another contact via the tape recorder. It went as follows. What is bothering you?
App, we need some clarification about what our work is about.
You must be patient, very patient. You are working 24 hours a day for us, but you don't even realize it. You are to Helbury. It is not important where you live, you must be on Earth only wherever you are.
App, how is my mind being used?
Your mind is being used 24 hours a day in a way that we cannot yet explain to you. You feel it now by being tired and sick. But this will not last for too long.
App, did you cause the blackout in Israel on January 14th of this year?
The power failure in Israel is from us.
App, what use do you make of the power failure?
It is a matter you will not understand yet.
App, where will Uri and I be this year?
I can only tell you that you will be in the USA part of the time.
Handle Uri gently.
He has nothing to worry about.
App, can we go aboard your spaceship in order to start learning more about you?
It will be a long time before this is possible, perhaps years.
We are not ready for you yet.
We are learning a lot.
App, when will the knowledge book come?
The reference to the knowledge book is based on a previous conversation, not here recorded. The knowledge book is a document which contains information important to man's future. See page 176, in due time, it may take years. But when it comes, it will be the most historical event that man will ever receive.
App, I received a phone call from you on February 5th, at 5 p.m. at the Hilton Hotel. You said, spaceman over West Germany.
Spaceman over West Germany.
That was all.
What does this mean?
We noticed them over West Germany.
We wanted you to know about it.
I spoke to you on the phone about it, said it two times.
We need your help in Germany.
App, what can we do?
We are quite helpless.
You will go to Germany.
We will tell you when.
App, are Uri and I in any danger?
No, nobody knows about you there.
App, where has my Horace Hawk gone?
The Hawk was your guard.
You are being guarded in an entirely different way.
App, why did Ayla come here?
She was sent to you as part of a test.
The test was successfully passed.
Farewell.
Now, going back somewhat in time, I want to recount my relationship to the Israeli army. On January 24th I had a meeting in Tel Aviv with Jakov. He informed me that there was grave concern in the army high command about me. He did not specify the nature of the concern, except to report that as far as the intelligence people were concerned, I had vanished from view on December 7th. This surprised me so much that I had to laugh aloud. But Jakov, I've been living in public view first at the Hotel Sharon and then the Hotel Masada. Reuven has visited me. I have talked to you. What can they mean?
Jakov did not elaborate on this statement but suggested that I contact a certain general. I said I would think about it. It was some 3 months later that I found out what Jakov's enigmatic statement meant. It was on December 7th that strange things began to happen to the intelligence operatives watching me, and to their equipment and recordings. And now the problem had reached the level of a crisis in the Israeli domestic intelligence apparatus. But again I was innocent of this storm brewing around my head. That afternoon I was to see the hawk once again while on the beach at Ashkelon. But nothing unusual happened to me. During the next 2 weeks the pressures from all sides built up, and I realized that I was a source of great mystery to the Israelis. I was even told that I was suspected of being one of the great master spies of history. But I did not know what the grounds were for this building suspicion. On February 13th I left Israel, as described at the beginning of this narrative. I previously stated that I started to reconstruct my confiscated Israeli journals in Italy. However, it was not until November 1972 that I began to work seriously on this book. On March 29, 1972, I received in Italy a phone call from Solveig Clark, who was in New York. She said that she had received a call from an anonymous female voice which said, "The Israeli army is not interested in detaining Dr. Puharich. Dr. Puharich is deluded by thinking that the Israeli army considers him a master spy. Please give this message to Dr. Puharich." The phone call terminated. Now, Yuri had given me no assurance in our phone conversations since I left Israel that I should or could return to Israel. But after the phone call from Solveig, I decided that this was a clear invitation for me to return to Israel. I went to Rome and spent Easter Sunday with Melanie Toyofaku, who was living there. I set up a plan with her to secure my release, should I be arrested in Israel. The plan was simple: if she did not hear from me by telephone every 48 hours by a certain hour, she was to alert officials in Washington, D.C., that I was missing. I flew into Lod Airport on April 3, 1972. I had had a pleasant trip chatting with a Roman Catholic priest from Boston who was making his first trip to the Holy Land. We got to know each other quite well. After we landed, I was standing in line with this priest at passport control. The page system announced, "Dr. Puharich, go to the nearest phone for a message." The priest said to me, "Why, Dr. Puharich, that call is for you." I nodded assent and thought quickly. This could be a trick of the Shin Beth to get me to leave the crowd and then arrest me inconspicuously. Or it could be a page from Ori. I said to the priest, "I'll pick up that call after I get into the terminal." As I stood in line to have my passport examined, I felt sure that I would be detected. But I was passed without comment. I picked up my two bags and cleared customs. There were Ori, Shippy, and Hannah waiting for me. We quickly got into Uri's car and sped away from the airport. Yuri explained that I could not stay at his new apartment, it had been wired up for total surveillance by the Shin Beth. Ever since I had left Israel he had been under continuous interrogation by the intelligence people. He was so rattled that he almost came to believe I was a spy. Finally, though, the Shin Beth concluded that I was not. But it was either a scientific genius or a charlatan. They had attributed to me all the effects that is had done to them. Yuri told me about the following event, which had happened while I was in Italy. One day there came for me in the mail a package with technical data and pricing for Xerox copiers. Yuri got panicky thinking that this would be interpreted as evidence that I was a spy, so he tore up the Xerox literature and flushed it down the toilet. The next day at Army headquarters, he was asked about the material he destroyed and flushed down the toilet. He denied that he had done this. Then the officer reached under his desk and placed before Rory a plastic bag containing the torn papers from the toilet flush. Yuri confessed to his crime, and everyone had a good laugh about the incident. As for me, I roared with laughter, imagining the condition of the hapless soldier assigned to this new kind of latrine duty. I asked Uri about the page call for me when I had landed. He had not paged me. We found out later that the army people had not paged me. We concluded eventually that this page was from Iz.
Yuri's mother later told me that she had received a phone call from me from Rome on Saturday, April 1st, at 1 p.m. I supposedly had said, I am returning to Ludd at 5:30 p.m., Saturday, April 1st, on TWA Flight 840. I never made such a phone call. As I checked into the Hilton Hotel, loud music blared out of my locked suitcase. I opened the suitcase to find the radio playing, but the power switch was turned in the off position. I knew that I was being welcomed back to Israel and to work. On April 5th at 12:30 p.m. the telephone rang. A human-sounding voice with a bit of an accent said in English, Andrea, listen well. Instructions will be coming on June 1st. Then silence. I immediately called the hotel operator. No outside phone call had come in for me, and no insider at the hotel had called. The next night, in front of three witnesses, my house keys from my home in New York suddenly appeared on a coffee table. I had last seen these keys months before on November 17, 1971, when I had put them in the custody of my house caretaker. Earlier on the same day my Minox C camera, which had been confiscated by the Shin Beth on February 13, had appeared on Uri's bed. One of the most spectacular feats of his occurred on April 10, 1972, at 10:10 p.m. in my room, 1434 at the Hilton Hotel. Yuri was lying on one of the twin beds talking to me, I was sitting in an easy chair listening. My universal Geneve watch with a new heavy silver chain band was lying on a dresser near Uri. Suddenly he screamed, and there was my Geneve watch firmly clamped around his left wrist. It had occurred instantly. He had felt nothing unusual on his skin except the shock of a foreign object. 25 minutes later the watch vanished from his wrist and was back on the dresser again. In both translocations of the watch the time and movement remained normal. On the night of April 11th I noticed a red light on the seashore jetty below the hotel. I grew curious and walked to the end of the jetty, but the red light was gone. Back in my hotel room, I saw it again. Yuri joined me, and we watched it for 2 hours. It was like the light we had seen in the Sinai, but now it was on the ground. The next morning the sea off the Hilton was patrolled by a submarine, 13 PT boats, and 5 submarine chasers. Rumor had it that radar had spotted an enemy submarine off the coast near the Hilton. That night Uri was interrogated all night by the Shin Beth as to where I was hiding. His answer was, don't you know? Yuri believes that the Shin Beth never knew I was in Israel. But I thought things were getting warm and that I had better leave the country again. On April 14th at 2 p.m. Uri and I was successful in getting information from Iz on the tape recorder. We have a short script for you, general guidance. Go to United States. Your work will be in Europe. Work starts in Germany with a man chosen. Main base henceforth in Israel. Detailed instructions on June 1st. Yuri will have his powers wherever he is. Do a movie on Uri. Melanie is the one to do it. Work at it, it will come out at right time. You are not to entrust anyone with the secret of our existence, no one. Do not interfere with our educational Israel Army program. We will contact you once more before you leave Israel. We showed ourselves to you in the sea by the hotel on April 11th. On April 15th at 8:55 p.m. the tape recorder yielded answers to our questions. App, why did you allow my journals to be taken by the Shin Beth? Don't ask. App, where should Uri and I be on June 1st? You will get instructions. App, how can Uri and I contact you if we need help when there is danger? There will not be danger. App, but if I think there is danger, will the hawk appear? You are right. App, since you do not show yourselves on Earth, will we be transported to your environment so that we can meet directly? Someday, yes. Of the people who have been exposed thus far to your powers, who should we continue to work with? Only 3. Yuri, Shimshon, you. We cannot use our full powers unless you and Uri and Shimshon are together. There is a dematerialized aspect to your atoms that we can use. Farewell. When I saw Uri off to his car parked in front of the Hilton Hotel, we first looked into the car. On the seat in front of our eyes appeared Uri's rather large Sony CR-150 radio.
We had last seen it in his apartment where he had left it earlier. The day to leave Israel finally came. Azuri and I drove to the airport. It was like approaching a potential ambush. We wondered what would happen to me and what would happen to Uri. Uri told me emphatically that based on his contacts and interrogations, he felt that the Israeli intelligence people did not know I was in Israel. I was not that optimistic because I still had to run the gauntlet of a ticket counter, baggage check, passport control, body search, and hand baggage check. On April 16, 1972, at 9:07 a.m. the wheels of TWA Flight 841 left the soil of Israel. At last I experienced a deep feeling of safety. I looked down at the green fields, the sandy shoreline, the towers of Herzliya Heights, the Sharon, the Hilton where it had all happened. Now I was on my way to Italy, to Germany, to the United States, to carry the message of Uri to the world. But I also was carrying a secret out of Israel that I was not to reveal. How could I carry the message of Uri and not the message of the intelligence of Is? These thoughts were heavy on my heart as my flight landed for its first stop in Athens. I disembarked and wandered around the terminal building. A TWA female representative walked up to me and asked me for my transit card, boarding pass, ticket, and passport. My heart sank. Had they caught up with me here in Greece? How did this woman know who I was, out of the hundreds of people milling around? I was determined not to be trapped this time. Politely I asked, "What is the problem?" She said, "I have a telex here from Tel Aviv, and it says that they do not have your ticket for this flight. Did you turn it in?" I distinctly remember that my passenger ticket was detached from my ticket when my baggage was checked, so I said, "Of course, I saw it collected." She asked to examine my documents. While she did so, I stood by in the passenger terminal keeping my eye open for her colleagues. She handed me my documents and said, "It is apparent that you don't have the ticket, it was removed, and you have all the necessary boarding cards. We shall check it out and let you know. You may board the flight." Once aboard the plane I could hardly wait for flight 841 to get airborne for Rome. Soon we were aloft, and I figured out what had happened. Is had vanished my ticket after I had turned it in so that my name did not appear on the passenger manifesto at the boarding gate. The ticket must have been found eventually, because I never heard from the TWA people again. Chapter 7, Seven Pillars of Fire. I returned to New York to take care of my long-neglected personal and business affairs. In mid-May I went to Chicago to attend the 25th annual reunion of my medical school class at Northwestern University. While in Chicago I found that Captain Edgar Mitchell was the featured speaker for the annual meeting of the Spiritual Frontiers Fellowship. Mitchell planned to devote his time after retirement from the Navy to consciousness research. He offered to raise money and manage a United States-based research program whose first venture was to be a study of Uri. I promised him that he would have the right to do the first United States research on Uri, provided he could raise the necessary funds, and would manage the effort. As June 1st approached, I got more and more apprehensive about the forthcoming instructions. What would be the next crisis that Uri and I would work on? Where would we have to move on planet Earth? How could we support ourselves? The rumor mill that had been generated in the United States about Uri's evil powers helped me enormously in that I did not have to explain anything to anybody about my long absence from the United States. My daughter Illyria and I were home alone in Ossining at midnight June 1st. I waited for the next 24 hours for the instructions. None came. I began to have doubts. Why had they not kept the promised rendezvous? On June 2nd Uri phoned me from Rome to tell me what had happened to him in Tel Aviv the day before. On the morning of June 1st at 7 a.m. he drove the 2 miles from his mother's apartment to his new apartment, and when he opened his door, there was a sealed letter on the floor. The letter was from me on my stationery in my handwriting, duly stamped and postmarked June 1, 1972, Ossining, New York. He thought this very strange because at that time it was not yet June 1 in New York. He read the enclosed letter from me, which said, "Dear Uri, I must remain in the U.S. for another 3 months,
Probably September or October before I can join you in Germany. Sorry for change of plans. Shalom, Andrea. Now, I must emphasize the importance of the fact that I did not write Uri such a letter. When Uri told me its contents, I was hearing it for the first time. But Uri, when he read the letter, really believed that I had written it. When he got on the plane on June 2 to fly to Rome, he put my letter in the breast pocket of his shirt. On the flight he suddenly noticed that the letter had vanished from his pocket. He searched the plane but could not find the letter. Then he realized that the letter had vanished and that the contents must be the promised instructions from Iz. Uri went to Munich to work with Yasha Katz, whom I had selected as his manager, and was there from June 7 to 12. One series of events that happened in Munich is worth recording. Uri was introduced to a lyricist by the name of Herr Brandin, who wished to see Uri work. On Friday, June 9, 1972, Herr Brandin and 10 of his guests saw Uri do the following things: a crystal ball materialized before the witnesses, a professional movie camera weighing 20 kilograms was levitated, lead wire was transmuted into gold. Professor Fried Butkaja, of the Max Planck Institute for Plasma Physics, witnessed some of these things and telephoned me from Munich to tell me about them. He was most impressed with Uri's powers and wanted to start a research program immediately. I welcomed his support but told him of the prior commitment to Captain Mitchell, so Dr. Gaja agreed to join the newly formed theory group. Uri cleaned up his affairs in Israel so that he could move to Germany, where he was told to go by Iz by July 1, 1972. As a result of the June 1 letter, I settled down in the United States and assembled a staff to carry out my scientific research program. Melanie Toyofuka came from Rome to begin the research preparatory to planning for a documentary movie on Uri. Caroline White came from Florence, Italy, to coordinate the university research efforts. Solveig Clark worked part-time with us in the publications area. Sydney Crystal assumed the legal tasks that had to be done. With this loyal group of associates, I was able to initiate and carry out a program whose specific purpose was to alert the scientific world to the existence of the powers that Uri and I had witnessed. Captain Mitchell undertook the problem of raising funds to carry out the first validation research on Uri. Validation meant the scientific verification of the claims I made for Uri's powers in the areas of telepathy, clairvoyance, and psychokinesis. I took on the task of mobilizing and informing some of the scientists who had been a part of the Life Energies Conference of 1970. Here I ran into my first problem. One of my Israeli colleagues had already approached this same group of scientists with a tale of evil powers. I approached some members of this group first with a written report and eventually introduced Uri to them individually, who then gave a demonstration of his powers. What happened among this group of mature scientists was an interesting sample of human reactions to Uri and his powers. About half of the men and women we approached believed the rumors concerning Uri's evil powers. By this I mean that they were fearful enough of Uri by prior stories that they did not even want to meet him personally. The other half who saw Uri demonstrate his powers believed the evidence of their own senses and judgment but were completely baffled. They could find no scientific explanations and therefore had no idea how to cope with the phenomenon. In order to deal with the problems of scientific importance, I organized a group of scientists into a theory group, whose goal was to find a theoretical framework that could accommodate the effects exhibited by Uri. The leadership of this group was eventually assumed by Dr. Ted Bastin, of Cambridge University, England. In cooperation with the theory group, a formal proposal for further research on Uri Geller was made to the U.S. National Science Foundation, NSF. Captain Mitchell personally carried this proposal to Dr. Gayford Stever, the director of NSF. The same proposal was personally delivered to a key member of the President's White House staff. I might state now that this attempt at open discussion of Uri's powers in the United States failed. None of the parties we reached was prepared to consider seriously the new data that Uri Geller was bringing to science. My next concern was to make an announcement of the verifiable scientific data that I had collected on Uri in Israel in an appropriate academic meeting. I got such an opportunity through invitations to speak at two meetings, one at Stanford University and the other at University of California at Los Angeles in late September 1972. These meetings were sponsored by the Academy of Parapsychology and Medicine. Thus the summer passed in the preparation of lectures, reports, proposals, and in many meetings and telephone conferences. My personal conviction was that Uri and his powers would never receive acceptance in a serious way until he ran the gauntlet of scientific evaluation by established scientists in a prestigious scientific institution. Captain Mitchell had concentrated his efforts on trying to arrange for validation experiments at Kent State University, where he had the personal support of the president, Dr. Glenn Olds, and a professor and coordinator of graduate studies in physics, Dr. Wilbur Franklin. However, the enthusiasm and deep interest in this experiment on the part of these fine scholars could not produce the funds and the other resources required to do the experiment. So on my own initiative, and with Captain Mitchell's permission, I opened up discussions with two scientists, Dr. Harold Puthoff and Mr. Russell Tagg, about doing the validation experiments. They welcomed the idea of working with Uri Geller and agreed to accept the experimental design of the theory group for this study and to accept Captain Mitchell as the sponsor of the project in terms of being the funding and contracting agent. Since they had been successful in getting Stanford Research Institute, SRI, to support their plans for parapsychology research, they arranged for Captain Mitchell to meet with the officials of SRI and work out all the details of the research project. We set a target date to begin the validation experiments for the first week in November 1972. This is merely a brief summary of the planning for the scientific research with Uri, which omits all the headaches that arose in the coordination of so many people in a highly controversial subject. Uri's work in Germany was going well. He gave many public demonstrations of his powers, which have been adequately covered by the German press and television. He and Shippey entertained themselves there in a style that Uri had never experienced, and he enjoyed every moment. It also helped to erase from his mind the heavy burden of the knowledge of his role in the affairs of humanity. But I had to shatter this temporary oasis of comfort by calling him to the United States in late August to meet Captain Mitchell and some of the scientists he was going to work with. Professor Gerald Feinberg, of the Physics Department of Columbia University, was present to see what Uri could do. He had been waiting to see him in person since November 1970. When he had heard the letter report on Uri given at the International Life Energies Conference. Uri did not disappoint this distinguished physicist as he moved the hands of a watch and broke a ring and a steel sewing needle. Professor Feinberg agreed that Uri's abilities should be the subject of careful scientific study. This opinion was shared by another scientist who was present, Dr. Wilbur Franklin. Many other people came to meet Uri during this period, and all were impressed with his honesty and with his powers. Uri on his part began to feel hemmed in and pressured by all this unusual attention from scientists. And when he begins to feel that his freedom is being eroded the least bit, Uri reacts defensively. Captain Mitchell, who was thoroughly impressed with Uri, was the first to sense this reluctance on Uri's part to be a guinea pig for science. When the scientists had left, we had a reading of the first draft of the documentary movie script about Uri written by Melanie. Uri suddenly began to show more and more signs of irritation as the script was read. Finally he stopped the reading and went into a monologue. "Here you are, all of you. You have been working for months on this movie script. All my life I wanted and waited for a movie about me. Now it is almost here, and I don't want it. What is wrong with me? Why am I so unhappy? Look at the chance I now have to progress in my career, yet something is wrong. Why am I behaving in this way? I now feel that something big has to happen, and I don't know what. I know it is not this movie, or Mitchell, or science. Are the two powers here who are fighting over me? They disturb some other people, or they disturb us here. They are so powerful. We have no idea why they are here. Look, I have some little powers by myself, but the big powers come from above. There's something funny about them. I still find it very funny that they will transport a bottle of cologne from Andrea's room on the 14th floor of a hotel down to the dining room in the basement. I think somebody is playing games with us. Perhaps they are a civilization of clowns. Or maybe one of their clowns escaped and he is playing jokes with us.